That line, Zeron Zeter describes the coronavirus outbreak as the main problem this country is facing, calling on officials to take all necessary measures to fight the pandemic. Iran's new president, Ebrahim Raisi, submits his list of proposed ministers to the parliament. And local reports say hundreds of Afghan soldiers have surrendered to the Taliban in Kunduz following the militant group's capture of the northern city. Our top story for this half hour, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says the coronavirus pandemic is the main problem the country is facing. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei urged officials to provide vaccines both through imports and domestic production. He also slammed some foreign countries for failing to abide by their promises in providing vaccines to Iranians. Ayatollah Khamenei warned that the country's health staff is grappling with a great deal of pressure amid a steep rise in cases and deaths. He also urged all Iranian citizens to abide by health protocols in an effort to deal with the crisis. South Korea reports a record number of over 2,200 daily COVID-19 cases, the highest since the pandemic started last January.
With the recent spread of the more transmissible Delta variant virus, the number of confirmed cases is increasing, showing mass infection cases from workplaces, indoor sport facilities, churches, and nursing hospitals. Along with that, the rate of investigating the path of infection is also rising, which means silent spreaders within communities is increasing.
Health Minister Kwon Dog-chol says infections have increased due to the spread of the more transmissible Delta variant and a rise in domestic travel over summer. He urged people who return from holidays to voluntarily get tested before going back to work. South Korean health officials have so far registered more than 216,000 cases with over 2,100 deaths. Some 42% of the country's 52 million population have received at least one dose of vaccine, while the government's target is to increase the number to 70% by September. Australian authorities have extended a lockdown in Melbourne for another 7 days after failing to curb the latest COVID outbreak. 5 million residents of Australia's second largest city will remain under stay-at-home orders until August 19th. That's mainly due to the emergence of a fresh outbreak of the highly infectious Delta variant. Melbourne has been under lockdown for 6 weeks. Sydney is also in its seventh week of lockdown, putting more than 5 million people under stay-at-home orders. Australia's total coronavirus cases have exceeded 37,000, while the death toll stands at over 940. The U.S. administration says all school districts should follow federal masking guidelines as some Republican governors resist the mandates amid a surge in coronavirus cases. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki hailed the schools in the states of Texas and California have imposed mask mandates defying governor's orders. She said the government is looking for ways to support those schools as the governors have threatened to level financial penalties on them. U.S. health authorities said late last month that everyone in schools should wear masks amid a surge in coronavirus cases among the minors. Children account for 15% of new cases reported last week. According to the American Academy of Pediatrics. The spike has prompted health experts to call upon the federal government to fast-track vaccine approval for those under the age of 12. Iran's new president, Ebrahim Raisi, submits the list of his proposed cabinet ministers to parliament. Among the names submitted to the parliament are Ahmad Vahidi for the Ministry of Interior, Hossein Amir Abdullahian for the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Javad Oji for the Ministry of Petroleum, and General Mohammad Reza Qaroi Ashtiani for the Ministry of Defense. The Parliament will review the submitted list for a vote of confidence. Well, Iran has once again rejected the U.S. and U.K. allegations that the Islamic Republic was behind a recent attack on an Israeli-managed oil tanker off Oman. This after Washington and its allies, including Israel, renewed their accusation against Tehran during a UN Security Council meeting on Monday. We have more in this report.
Iran has once again denied having any link to the recent attack on an Israeli-managed oil tanker off Oman. Iran's deputy permanent representative to the UN, Zahra Ershadi, dismissed the accusations as politically motivated, saying there is no verifiable and conclusive evidence to substantiate the claim. Ershadi also urged the Council to avoid being trapped by the fabrications of the Israeli regime, which as usual are blindly supported by certain Western countries. The Iranian diplomat responded to renewed accusations by the U.S. and its allies during Security Council meeting. During the virtual session, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken even vowed to punish Iran for the alleged attack. Iran has repeatedly rejected the accusations, warning that it will not hesitate to give a crushing response to any threat against its national security. Chief Commander of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, Major General Hossein Salami, also warned Israel not to shorten its life by making a wrong and aggressive move. The Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council said that Iran is carefully monitoring the suspicious moves by the U.S., the U.K. and Israel in the region.
Such moves are made to create chaos and confusion among countries in the Persian Gulf area. Tehran is ready to neutralize any plot to destabilize the region.
Following the ship incident, resistance sources told a media outlet that the attack was in retaliation for a recent deadly Israeli airstrikes on a Syrian airport. But Washington and London have thrown their weight behind Israel in its blame game against Iran while turning a blind eye to Israel's own hostile acts in the region. According to a report by Wall Street Journal, over a dozen of Iranian vessels had fallen victim to the Israeli attacks, some of which openly claimed by the regime. It seems that the West is trying to shift the international attention from Israel's frequent deadly attacks on the Gaza Strip and Syria, as well as its atrocities in the occupied territories. Such a stance will simply embolden Tel Aviv to push ahead with its crimes with impunity. Nonetheless, the ongoing plot against Iran is just exposing the weakness of a regime the U.S. and its Western allies had created in the occupied Palestine. The attack on an Israeli-managed ship and Israel's defeat in its war on Gaza at the hands of resistance groups spotlight the regime's weakness. This also shows the era of hit and run for Israel has come to an end.
Palestinian factions have denounced Saudi Arabia over its verdict against 69 Palestinians and Jordanians that handed over jail terms of up to 22 years. The group was detained in March 2018 during a wave of arrests by Saudi authorities. Ruba Shabat has more from Gaza.
Saudi Arabia issued sentences against 69 Palestinians and Jordanians residing in the kingdom, with some handed jail terms up to 22 years while acquitting a number of detainees. Among the detainees is Hamas senior member Mohammed al-Khudri, who was sentenced to 15 years. His son was also given a 3-year jail term. Palestinians have slammed the court ruling, saying it follows the Israeli goal of defeating the Palestinian resistance.
This was shocking news for us, as we never expected things would reach this level. They sentenced a national man who is representing his country and works within the law of Saudi Arabia. Mohammed didn't pass the limits, and he was guided and directed by Saudi authorities. It is really sad for us, as they don't have any right to sentence him to this term. This verdict is unjustified.
In February, al-Khudri had a surgery. He was being treated for cancer when Saudi authorities arrested him. Al-Khudri, who has been in charge of working on ties with Saudi Arabia for 2 decades, is now on a wheelchair inside the Saudi jail.
I hope things will be better and we will get our brother and his son released, as he is an old man while his health is deteriorating. He has recently done a surgery for his cancer and he is on wheelchair. I hope Saudi authorities reconsider this ruling and stand by the Palestinians.
Hamas and the Palestinian factions have condemned the sentences, calling them unjust, saying those sentenced had done nothing to harm Saudi Arabia. Hamas also welcomed the acquittal of some of the detainees and called on Saudi authorities to quickly release them.
We totally condemn this decision and reject the ruling against our sons in Saudi Arabia, and we consider them political prosecutions. Saudi Arabia doesn't have the right to sentence those people who didn't commit any offense against the kingdom and its people. This is an unjust decision, as Saudi Arabia has always supported Palestinians, but now it is trying to satisfy the U.S. and Israel. We call on Saudi authorities to release those detainees.
Palestinians here say the Israeli move further sours relations between the Palestinian nation and Saudi Arabia, calling on Riyadh to release those detainees as they have caused no harm and not committed any offense. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
Hundreds of Afghan soldiers have surrendered to the Taliban in a northern provincial capital captured by the militants over the weekend. Local officials say the soldiers who retreated to the airport of Kunduz city have also turned in all their military gear. Kunduz is one of nine provincial capitals taken by the group in less than a week. Faizabad is the latest provincial capital to fall into the militants following days of heavy fighting. The Taliban have seized dozens of districts and border crossings in recent weeks and is now battling for several key cities. They've intensified their offensive in the wake of the withdrawal of U.S. foreign forces. Amin Alimi says Faizabad fell into the hands of the Taliban after a large-scale attack on the city.
Over 900 Taliban militants, including some foreign nationals, had conducted a large-scale attack from four directions on the city of Faizabad. As a result, and as these military commanders there say, Afghan military forces have retreated and they are fighting still against the Taliban militants who are following Afghan security forces very close to Faizabad airport. In the meantime, the rest of areas in northern Afghanistan and northeast of Afghanistan, also the scene of collapse of big cities into the hands of Taliban. For instance, Shebirghan, the capital city of Juzjan province, is under the control of Taliban. After that, the Taliban captured Talikhan, the capital of northeastern Tahar province, and then Aibak city, the capital of Samangan province, came under the control of Taliban militants. And currently, fierce fightings are underway between both sides. I mean, Afghan security forces backed by local armed fronts and Taliban militants in the suburbs and inside some parts of the city of Pule Khumri, the capital city of Baghlan province. That is another northern province that connects northern Afghanistan to the Afghan capital Kabul via Parwan province.
Well, North Korea says the South and the United States are risking, quote, a huge security crisis by choosing to escalate tensions. State media cited a top Workers' Party official as saying that Seoul and Washington responded to Pyongyang's goodwill with hostile acts. The statement comes a day after Pyongyang slammed Seoul for going ahead with its annual military exercises with the U.S. even after the North agreed to restore inter-Korean hotlines in late July. On Tuesday, North Korea stopped answering routine calls on the hotlines. The United States has more than 28,000 troops in South Korea. Pyongyang has always criticized Washington's Seoul joint military drills and viewed them as a threat. Our Seoul correspondent Jennifer Chang tells us more about the recent escalation of tensions between North and South Koreas.
Just 2 weeks after the two Koreas restored their severed hotlines, which were severed about a year ago, the South is already conducting nuclear war exercises with the U.S., according to the North, and they have to be able to rapidly respond to that. So they say that even though these nuclear war exercises are tabletop exercises right now, which are only computer-simulated drills, that they are demanding that that is not enough, that the U.S. has to pull out all of its troops from ally South Korea and all of its military hardware. So now that leaves the South in a position where they have got to watch what's going on, and they are extremely concerned. The South Koreans, not all of them, but most of them, favor more engagement with North Korea, more willingness to compromise with the North. So I am sure that these moves by the Moon Jae-in administration to try to placate the U.S. by holding these tabletop exercises so soon after the hotlines were restored are not being received very well here in South Korea.
According to China, sentenced a Canadian businessman to 11 years in jail on charges of spying. A statement from a court in Dandong said the businessman illegally provided state secrets to other countries. Michael Spavor was detained in 2018, days after Canada detained telecoms giant Huawei chief financial officer Meng Wanzhou on a U.S. extradition request. Spavor's verdict comes a week after fresh hearings in the Meng case began in Vancouver. As her lawyers fight to prevent her extradition to the U.S. on Tuesday, another Chinese court rejected an appeal by a Canadian who was sentenced to death for drug smuggling. Ottawa has condemned the verdicts, calling them politically motivated and unjust. In U.S. embattled New York, Governor Andrew Cuomo has announced his resignation amid sexual harassment allegations against him. In a televised address, Cuomo said he accepted full responsibility and apologized to any women he said may have been offended by his actions. He, however, defended his conduct and denied sexual harassment allegations, adding that he didn't realize the extent to which the line had been redrawn. Cuomo said his resignation would take effect in 14 days. Last week, a report by the New York Attorney General's office found that Cuomo engaged in sexual harassment of 11 women. With Cuomo leaving office, Lieutenant Governor Kathy Hochul will become New York State's first female governor. And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Imam Khamenei, the supreme leader of the Islamic Revolution, has encouraged both the people and officials to carefully observe the health protocols for the prevention of COVID-19 from the early days of the outbreak. In addition, he himself has obeyed the regulations enacted by the National Committee on Combating Corona even more than others. Moreover, His Eminence has reminded both the people and officials of the necessity of observing the enacted rules in various speeches. Unfortunately, we sometimes see on television that in certain places and discussions, there are some people and some officials who do not even wear a mask or who do not wear it correctly, who show negligence and who do not observe social distancing regulations. Officials should observe these regulations. When officials do not do so, the people feel that observing them is not really necessary. October 24th, 2020. Advice to the people. Of course, the honorable officials in this area have given certain instructions which should be acted on, God willing. Everyone should comply with them. These instructions are for the sake of saving your own lives and those of other people, and for controlling this dangerous disease. Therefore, everyone should carry them out. March 22nd, 2020. I have a few requests to make to our dear people. One is that they should not ignore the recommendations and instructions given by the officials in charge. Instructions concerning prevention, keeping one's hands and face and the living environment clean, and trying to avoid contaminating these. They should act on the instructions given by experts. Surely everything that leads to society's health and everything that helps prevent the disease from becoming rampant is a good deed, and on the contrary, everything that helps the disease become widespread is a sin. Allah the Exalted has made us responsible towards our own health and that of others, and the health of the people. So the first word of advice is that we should consider it our responsibility to completely observe the instructions specified by officials and to act on them. March 3rd, 2020.
Iraq and Syria have been struggling with poverty and instability for years. The U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003 and Washington and its allies' support for opposition groups and al-Qaeda affiliates in Syria, as well as crippling economic sanctions, merely added fuel to the fire of instability there and gave birth to Daesh. Since Daesh terrorists emerged in Iraq and Syria, Iran has been providing advisory assistance to the two countries' armies in their fight against the terrorists. On August 7, 2017, Daesh terrorists captured a member of an Iranian advisory support team in Syria near the Tanf border crossing in the southeast of the country. 2 days later, on August 9, Mohsen Hojaji was beheaded by the Takfiri terrorists. The terrorist group published photos and videos of Hojaji's arrest and beheading. The act prompted widespread condemnation of the terrorist group, as well as the admiration of the soldiers who were fighting against it. In a meeting with the family of Hojaji, leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei hailed Hojaji as an emblem of sincere and courageous martyrdom and called the Takfiri groups puppets of the United States and Britain. Also, late Iranian commander of the Quds Force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, Qasem Soleimani, slammed the incident as a horrific, inhumane crime. that came in the wake of successive blows dealt on several fronts to Takfiri Wahhabi terrorist groups, which are linked to the world's imperialist power. He vowed not to rest until they have taken out every last terrorist from the face of the Muslim world. Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi Commander Abu Mehdi al-Muhandis, who played a decisive role in the full-scale fight against the Daesh terrorists, were assassinated in Baghdad airport in January 2020 in a U.S. drone attack. Two years after the 9/11 incident, the U.S. invaded Iraq and opened a second major front in its so-called War on Terror after invading Afghanistan. The invasion toppled Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein, but was followed by instability as well as deadly violence that took the lives of over a million Iraqis and displaced over 9 million more. Consequently, the chaos that resulted from the U.S. invasion finally gave birth to Daesh terror group in 2014. Elsewhere in Syria, the government has been grappled with foreign-backed militancy since March 2011, that later gave way to the presence of terrorist groups such as Daesh. Furthermore, over the past years, the U.S. has been leading a military coalition conducting airstrikes against purported targets of the Daesh Takfiri terrorist group inside Syria without any authorization from the Damascus government. However, numerous reports and official accounts have revealed the U.S. and Israel's involvement in the relocation of Daesh's elements across Syria and shipment of supplies to them. The U.S. has also been blamed for stealing and selling Syrian oil and other resources. Add to this list the crippling sanctions against the Damascus government. The U.S. has targeted Baghdad and Damascus with crippling economic sanctions, which have worsened the socio-economic conditions there.
First of all, let's say Iran is supporting all the freedom fighters in the world and fighting against the terrorists. Even, you know, like we call it, either we call it the Hujaija massacre, brutal killing by ISIS, and then al-Nusra later on. As we know that those movements, let's say, or organizations, according to what Hillary Clinton said, this is, or they were all created by United States.
Washington is directly responsible for the emergence of Daesh and the current instability and poverty that has afflicted the Iraqi and Syrian nations. Ironically, the U.S. punishes countries that are aiding Baghdad and Damascus to fight the Takfiri terrorists with economic sanctions and calls them terrorists. Aren't the real terrorists those who provide assistance for Daesh and worsen the living conditions of people by imposing economic sanctions on their countries? In a statement released on Saturday, the Iranian Foreign Ministry commemorated the Iranian diplomats and a journalist who were killed at the Consulate General of the Islamic Republic of Iran in Mazar-e-Sharif, Afghanistan, in August 1998. The Iranian Foreign Ministry condemned the terrorist attack, saying it was against all international laws and treaties. The body also announced that different aspects of the attack are required to be clarified, and this is a definite demand of the government and people of Iran. 23 years ago, the Taliban captured Mazar-e-Sharif. After that, the group admitted that 10 Iranian diplomats and a journalist had been killed during an attack on the Iranian consulate. The Taliban spokesman said the Iranians had been killed by renegade forces who had acted without orders. Furthermore, the ministry reiterated its call on all parties to the war in Afghanistan to end the conflict and seek a solution in the negotiations. That's while the UN Special Envoy for Afghanistan has warned that the country is heading toward a, quote, catastrophe.
In the past weeks, the war in Afghanistan has entered a new, deadlier, and more destructive phase. The Taliban campaign during June and July to capture rural areas has achieved significant territorial gains. From this strengthened position, they have begun to attack the larger cities.
The Taliban militants have stepped up their attacks across Afghanistan since May, seizing large swaths of rural and urban areas, including some key border crossings. They are now focused on capturing provincial capitals. The Taliban has also vowed to ramp up assaults against top government officials. The US B-52 bombers and Spectre gunships have reportedly targeted Taliban positions in northern Afghanistan. While there has been no confirmation of the airstrikes or possible damage by Taliban militants, Afghan Defense Ministry has declared that the airstrikes inflicted significant damage to the militants. The deployment of American bombers and gunships further highlights the degree of dependency of Afghan forces on US military support. Also, the development has further raised questions about the reliability of persistent claims made over the years by the US and NATO forces in Afghanistan, that they have primarily been engaged in training Afghan government forces to independently safeguard the country's security against various threats. Meanwhile, the airstrikes came as the militants advanced towards key cities. On Friday, the Taliban captured the capitals of two Afghan provinces in a matter of 24 hours, the city of Shebergan in Jawzjan and the city of Zaranj in Nimruz.
Of course, the Taliban cannot be expected to provide security to the embassies and diplomats of other countries. And as you mentioned, the incident of what happened at the Iranian embassy and the killing of Iranian diplomats was a very tragic event. But what more can we expect from Taliban? If you look at Taliban's history, if you look at Taliban's rule in Afghanistan, it's a rule of destruction, of violence and suppression. And I'm afraid we are again heading back into the situation.
Lebanon's resistance movement, Hezbollah, has fired dozens of rockets at open areas around the Israeli-occupied Sheba farms. In a statement, Hezbollah said it hit open fields near Israeli positions at 11:15 a.m. local time Friday using dozens of 122-caliber rockets. Lebanon's Al-Mayadeen television said at least 20 rockets were fired at Israel's military positions. Al-Minar TV said a number of the rockets targeted the Duf military base. A Lebanese security source said the rockets were launched from the area of Al-Arkoub near the Lebanese town of Sheba. Air raid sirens sounded in the Upper Galilee and in the Golan Heights, part of the territory Israel occupied in 1967. Israeli media said residents of settlements in the north of the occupied territories had been asked to stay in homes. The development came after Israeli jets struck what the regime's military claimed were sites where rockets had been launched earlier in the week.
Bombing Syria, bombing Lebanon is a way of their practice, a way of dividing new states and new communities to get legitimization for their sick political Zionist project. They try everything. They try everything to forbid building a civil state because this is their real threat to their ideology. Defending our land should not be alone through weapons and fighting, but with completing this with a political project which should be contradicted to the Sikh ideology of Zionism.
Regional resistance movements, including Palestinian Hamas and Yemeni Ansarullah, hailed their retaliatory attacks as a legitimate right against Israeli aggressions. Lebanon's parliament speaker, Nabih Berri, said in a statement that the attacks on his country reflected the true nature of Israel. He added that the regime only understands the language of, quote, unity and resistance. President Michel Aoun also denounced the Israeli raids as a direct threat to the security and the stability of the region. Hezbollah Deputy Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qassem also said the resistance movement is committed to the principle that any aggression on Lebanon will be met with a proper response, and for this reason, it responded to the aggressive enemy with rockets. He, however, downplayed the possibility that the situation would escalate to a full-blown war.
Fragmentation of this society, or of our societies, is no less dangerous than the threat of the Zionist project. managing its affairs, maintaining its cohesion in light of what we are experiencing is not separated from fighting the Zionist project, but it is the core of confronting it.
Israel's attacks on Lebanon's south followed the regime's similar airstrikes on Syria in recent months. The regime has recently threatened to take military action against Iran after accusing the Islamic Republic of being involved in a deadly attack on an Israeli-managed oil tanker off the coast of Oman, an allegation that Tehran has denied. The Islamic Republic has called on the United Nations Security Council to confront Israel's adventurism and reject its fabrications. Tehran says Israel is trying to distract the public attention away from the regime's crimes in the region, warning that any miscalculation on the Israeli side will be met with an immediate and crushing response.
Ibrahim Raisi is now officially the 8th president of the Islamic Republic of Iran after his mandate was endorsed by leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, at a ceremony in Tehran. Ayatollah Khamenei's decree endorsed the presidential mandate of Raisi. The text was read out at the event by head of the leader's office. The ceremony took place at Imam Khomeini Hosseiniyeh in Tehran in full compliance with COVID safety protocols and was attended by the country's senior state and military officials. Raisi said, through their participation in the election, the Iranian people sent a message that they are demanding change, justice, as well as a fight against corruption, poverty, and discrimination. For his part, Ayatollah Khamenei called for a swift formation of the administration and said the country's conditions do not warrant a delay in the process. Raisi is the 8th president of the Islamic Republic of Iran. He won almost 62% of the votes in the June 18th presidential election and will succeed President Hassan Rouhani, who served 2 4-year terms in office. Raisi will take an oath of office in an inauguration ceremony at the Iranian parliament, or Majlis, on Thursday. But his new government is set to face a series of challenges. First and foremost, Iran's economy needs urgent action and medium-term planning to grow. Cruel and illegal US sanctions and the COVID-19 pandemic have severely hampered Iran's economic growth. Iran is also dealing with an unprecedented drought, which has negatively affected its energy production and its agriculture sector in certain parts of the country.
So Iran has survived the American sanctions. I think they can continue as long as they use imaginative ways of implementing the exchange of goods and services by different currencies or barter.
Raisi has pledged to prioritize Iran's domestic needs and combat poverty, unemployment, inflation, and corruption. But in order to achieve that end, a certain give and take on regional issues is necessary, and Iran can prosper by playing an even greater stability role commensurate with the country's pivotal position.
Well, in my view, I think President Raisi won't necessarily remove the sanctions, but what he will do is increase Iran's ability to circumvent them. It's possible, for example, to use other currencies than the United States dollar to pay for trading back and forth.
Raisi has vowed not to repeat his predecessor's mistake of putting nearly all the bets on the nuclear deal and the resolution of foreign-imposed sanctions. He said he will decouple his agenda from the nuclear deal, known as the JCPOA, Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Raisi has called on the U.S. to live up to its nuclear deal obligations.
I think President Raisi is talking more about countries such as Iraq and Syria and Libya and Lebanon and neighboring countries such as Afghanistan and Pakistan. I think that relying on Saudi Arabia and Israel and the Gulf states is a non-starter.
Raisi has said time and again that his government will solidify the relationship between Iran and regional countries. He's described strong ties with Iran's neighbors as important for the economy.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Late Shahidi is trying to convey one message by giving this title that after 50 years, meaning that we have to trace back all events that took place in the scene of Karbala after the demise of the Prophet, everything that took place.
The author mentions that this Ibn Sa'd is the son of Sa'd ibn Abi Waqqas, commander of the army of Islam at the time of the Holy Prophet. Now the late Sayyid Shahidi asks this question, okay, what happens that after less than 50 years, his son is standing against the grandson of the Holy Prophet and decides to kill him?
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is The Teacher. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom for today's discussion, Hujjatul Islam Mahdavi and Hujjatul Islam Ziyaniya. Hujjatul Islam Mahdavi, assalamu alaikum, brother. Welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Thank you very much for accepting my invitation. And Hujjatul Islam Ziyaniya, assalamu alaikum, brother. Welcome to the show, The Teacher.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you.
You're welcome. In a series of the program, The Teacher, we are mainly concerned with the lives, biographies, and the works of the most outstanding Muslim thinkers, philosophers, and scholars from around the world, all around the nation of Islam. For today's discussion, we want to be concerned with a personality who is known as a university personality, but at the same time, he had studies in Hausa, especially in the Hausa of Najaf, and the books that he compiled regarding the religious studies, especially in the Persian and the Arabic language, are really magnificent, and he is no one but the late Sayyid Jafar Shahidi. Hujjatul Islam Mahdavi, let's get to you, brother, first. What information can you give us about the biography of Sayyid Jafar Shahidi?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As you mentioned, Sayyid Jafar Shahidi is one of the personalities that he is more known as a university personalities who speaks about the Islamic issues and religious issues. That's for right. Us as Iranians, his name is associated with the translation of Nahjul Balagha. So whenever you ask everybody, specifically elite people, about Sayyid Jafar Shahidi, the first thing which comes to their minds is the translation of Nahjul Balagha
into Persian language and Farsi language.
Definitely,
okay.
Yes.
That's right. Okay.
So besides his great work for Nahjul Balagha, we have a lot of works being done with Mr. Shahidi. We can name After 50 Years, which talks about the analytic history.
That's right.
About the uprising of Ashura.
Of course, I don't know. I'm not quite sure that we'll get to that book for today's session or not. But that's right. The main purpose in order to get to Sayyid Jafar Shahidi in the month of Muharram and producing program on him is the magnum opus that he produced on Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam after 50 years. And what does this 50 year refer to is very much important. Thank you very much up to now. I will get to Hujjatul Islam Ziyaniya. Hujjatul Islam Ziyaniya, he is known, as Mr. Mahdavi said, a person who is known for his university personality, and he was a professor at the University of Tehran. But what made him, in order to produce some works regarding religious studies. Was it the personal interest or his studies in Najaf? Who were his main professors?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As you mentioned, regarding the compiling these books, religious books, these books are written by him as a result of his personal interest and also his being expert in these fields. Because, you know, when he was young, he migrated to Najaf.
That's right.
As a clergyman. He studied there for something like 7-8 years.
Very good.
Less or more. And then he came back to Iran because of the sickness that he had. Mm-hmm. And he could not tolerate the situation in Najaf.
That's right.
Then even he migrated to Qom for some years, and again it was not possible for him because he needed to visit doctor every day.
That's right.
And this was not possible for him in Qom during those days.
That's right.
So he moved to Tehran, and from this moment he is changing, his personality is changing from a figure from Islamic seminary into a university.
That's
figure.
Right, professor. But it is documented that he benefited from Ayatollah Burujerdi and Ayatollah Khoui. And it, is it true that Sayyid Jafar Shahidi reached the level of ijtihad?
Let me mention this, that he was not the student of Ayatollah Burujerdi. It's famous
not?
Like that, but he was not his student. Because when he moved to Tehran, Ayatollah Burujerdi has just come to Qom.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they had some discussions, but he was not his student.
Okay.
I mean by a student, the one who is participating in the classes.
The lectures. Very good.
Yeah,
okay.
Frequently. So, but yes, he was a mujtahid, a prominent figure in fiqh.
That's right.
Jurisprudence. And he was knowledgeable in these fields. And he was knowledgeable in history also.
Mm-hmm.
When he moved to Tehran, he was teaching in some schools because of, you know, income that he
That's
was
right.
in need of.
Okay.
But simultaneously, he needed some, you know, official documents.
That's right.
So he moved to university, he started studying there, and at the same time teaching there.
Teaching there, very good. Thank you very much, Hojjat Islam Zainia. And Hojjat Islam Mahdavi, you know, the important case about the old generation, in the last 100 years of the Iranian scholars at the universities is that they had studied both religion and their own specific field of university one, the academic one. They had both this religious house and knowledge and the university ones. And mostly we can see that some of the scholars and the professors at different fields of studies at the University of Tehran were at the same time the students of great ulama in that time. Talk a little bit about this generation for us. I think this generation, both in terms of the Hausa and the university, were great, isn't it?
Okay, that's a good question. Maybe if we wanted to do some kind of sociology, what made these scholars to do both things, university and Hausa? I think, based on my opinion, because before the revolution, it was a kind of propaganda against people who would study in Hausa.
Mm-hmm.
This propaganda would tell people that these people have no knowledge, they're illiterate people.
That's
the only thing that they know is about doing worshipping acts and forbidding from the Muharramat, things
right.
like this.
Okay.
So for these people to go up the member and start speaking and delivering landmark speeches like somebody like Allama Mutahhari or the other figures that
yes.
we have, so they were in need of introducing themselves in a new picture.
That's right.
Saying that, okay, even in the university, we have done some good works.
That's right.
It is not like this, that the only thing that we have done is in the house.
Hausa, that's right.
For the university also, you see somebody like Allama Mutahhari who is delivering speeches and lectures for the doctors in
that's
the
right.
university.
That's
so
right.
it would kind of comprising or making a very exalted picture for somebody who has reached the level that doctors are listening to his speeches.
That's right.
So it was a kind of social urge or
mm-hmm.
need that they were required to do it.
That's right.
In order to make people accept them.
Mm-hmm. And this was great because Sayyid Jafar Shahidi was also among them. You know, consider a person like him who gets into the city of Najaf and gets up to the level of ijtihad. he came back. But of course, he is not wearing the imama or the turban, you know, the clerical turban. But at the same time, he has role, as you said, in Next Generation, in translating the Arabic texts into the Persian one. And this is very important. Hojatullah Samzi Ayniya, this man also wrote a book in a rebuttal to Ahmad Kesravi. You know, at that time, he was one of the main figures, the so-called broad-minded people on that time who wrote many things against the religion of Islam and the Shia Islam. But Sayyid Jafar Shahidi felt committed in order to answer him in a rebuttal. What was the story exactly?
Ahmad Kesravi is a figure that he himself was a religious figure.
Okay.
He was even a clergyman at the beginning of his life.
Mm-hmm.
And you know that he was from Tabriz.
That's right.
After some events, you know, those times were really hard to describe. And, you know, we are not belonging to that period of time. It was the period of wars, you know, World War II, and also before World War II, you know, between these two wars.
That's right.
And the poverty that was dominant during that period, and some problems among some religious people. Beside the problems that was in the mind of Ahmad Kesravi, we must add all these, elements together, put right. all under the same umbrella. Then we come to this conclusion that at the end, Ahmad Kesravi shifted from a religious person into
a secular one, maybe
completely secular, but right. somehow even we may call him, I'm not sure about
okay.
this term,
yes.
somehow atheist.
Atheist, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Someone who was pessimist about the religious beliefs, maybe we can say.
Something
it?
Beyond pessimist, because okay. he decided to burn the books.
Oh.
This is something beyond being pessimist.
Yes. Okay.
He had a gathering at the end of his life, during the last years of his life.
Mm-hmm.
He had a gathering during which he used to collect some books, and after collecting the books, he used to burn them
okay.
manually.
That's right.
So with this, Mr. Shahidi wants to stand against such a figure.
Okay.
But he writes a book to stand against him.
Mr. Shahidi writes a book in order to oppose
Ahmad
Kesravi.
Yes.
Okay.
So, and this book is Mahdaviyat Dar Islam.
Okay.
Because one of the most crucial questions in Shia school of thought during those times was the question of Mahdaviyat, because you know we had the problem of Babiyat during those times.
Okay, that's right.
So Mr. Shahidi wrote a book regarding this.
That's right.
And he wants to reject the mm-hmm. opinions of Ahmad Kesravi. So that, of course, Mr. Shahidi is not the only figure that he is trying this, you know, approach.
That's right.
We have other figures also. But unfortunately, Ahmad Kesravi did not change his mind.
That's
and
right.
up to the end of his life, mm-hmm. that he was killed by some of his enemies.
Yes, right.
He was on that way that...
That's right. But the case is that some people from a person who is the generation from Hausan University feels committed in order to answer, you know, such questions in an academic field by writing the books, and Sayyid Jafar Shahidi was one such a scholar who did so. We are out of time for today's discussion. We want to get, inshallah, into more details of the life of the late Sayyid Jafar Shahidi and his book, Pasas Panjosal, which, if you want to roughly translate it into English, after 50 years, this book is related to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and his movement. Inshallah, we'll talk about the upcoming session of the program. But for this episode, Hojat Hussam Ziyaniya, thank you very much. It was very kind of you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And Hojat Hussam Atavi, thank you very much, brother.
You're most welcome.
And dear listeners of iRibe English Radio, this is the teacher you are listening to. I'm Atta, the host of this program. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/en/Call of Islam page. Also, you can visit our YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Assalamu alaikum, ya Abu Abdullah.
Why is my heart set on fire when I hear your name?
Assalamu alaikum, ya Abu Abdullah.
كلام الله أبدا ما بقيت وبقي الليل والنهار
stream.
The explosion that shook our city of Beirut a year ago was something we have never seen in any Hollywood movie. I don't know of it if it's possible to make such a scene in even an animated movie either. I give only one piece of information to explain the horror of the incident. The quivering of this explosion was a 3.5 on the Richter scale. 218 people were killed in the blast of Beirut, a few of whom were on ground zero at the time of the explosion were never found. More than 7,000 were injured, and more than 300,000 people became instantly homeless. People from around the world expressed their sorrow at the suddenness of the incident, but the first punch was thrown by former US President Donald Trump. In a briefing at the White House shortly after the incident, he claimed that the explosion was a massive bomb attack. This raised a whole lot of questions for everyone as to who might have done it, how, and most importantly, why. On the other hand, the Lebanese government claimed since the beginning of the incident that more than 2,700 tons of ammonium nitrate were stored in the warehouse where the incident took place at the seaport. This made every one of us wonder why this huge amount of ammonium has been stored in a densely populated area since 2014. The fact so far is that the ammonium was recovered from a ship brought in illegally and stored in a warehouse at the seaport since 2014, and a whole lot of officials knew about it, including heads of state, prime ministers, and even, or rather mainly, the commander-in-chief of the Lebanese armed forces. The atrocity encapsulated everything that is rotten about Lebanon's governing system. The rampant corruption, the incompetent inaction, a system held hostage by a foreign power whose potence to be Lebanese defenders shattered this nation many times over. And last but not least, our eternal enemy, Israel, that benefited from every atrocity that have ever fallen upon my people, whether they had a hand in it or not. The lesson of the August 4 atrocity is that accepting that the US-French imposed regime means accepting leaders who think nothing of murdering their own citizens. If we allow Lebanon to continue fragmenting, it opens the door to catastrophes of an infinitely greater magnitude than the port explosion. This disaster must be our wake-up call for inaugurating a new Lebanon. There's no salvation for a system that is rotten to the core pushed by Western colonial powers. Our salvation is through collectively banishing those who colluded in Lebanon's downfall and who remain wedded to a medieval and inherently corrupt sectarian system. About 100 years ago, in 1923, Gibran wrote in The Prophet, "You need to know the secret of death. How can you know the secret if you do not know life?" But today, Gibran's Beirut does not know the secret of death as we struggle to decipher the meaning of our lives on this beautiful yet battered piece of land. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman.